Okay, awesome. So thank you all for joining us today. And I want to give a big thank you to Dave Caudill, who will be speaking with us this hour. So Dave is Associate Director of the Frist Center for Autism and Innovation at Vanderbilt University. So this interview is an element of IRI's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion community. The DEI provides resources and networking opportunities for members as you promote DE&I in your innovation and R&D practices. As the community grows, you'll be able to access facilitated roundtable discussions on key topics. These are generally the second Friday of the month, so the next one will be tomorrow. We'll be talking about leadership and follow on to this conversation too. We also have updates with insights and additional resources and interviews with thought leaders like we're doing today. And these almost always take place on the second Thursday of the month at 12 o'clock Eastern. We've got a conference going on next month. So next month, we'll be talking to Brennan Marcano of the GEM Fellows Program on October 20th. So we've moved it back by a week, but I hope to see you all there. Just a few housekeeping items to get through before we can begin our conversation. So first, this session is being recorded and you will get a link to the recording. We'll be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there won't be any visuals here today. Second, please hold all questions until the end. Once we open the floor to questions, you can type your question into the chat and I'll read it out for you, or you can jump in and unmute and bring yourself on video and have a face-to-face conversation. We'd love that too. All right, all the boring stuff out of the way. Again, Dave, thanks so much for joining me today. Can you tell us a bit about your background?
So I have a bit of an unusual background. I mean, I grew up in rural Tennessee, about 90 miles south of Nashville. I grew up on a farm. And I did a variety of careers. When I got out of high school, I spent 7 years in the Army as a soldier, a military journalist, photojournalist, media relations, public relations. I did a variety of jobs in the private sector. I worked anything from a car salesman to working for a corporation, everything from customer service to loss prevention. There was a lot of different things I tried. And I've always known that I struggled with things that most other people don't struggle with. I had difficulty understanding people, difficulty relating to people. I found people oftentimes confusing to understand, that people often seem to misunderstand me no matter how much work and effort I went into trying to be clear and concise. And I just knew that I was a weird guy. I always knew that I was a weird guy. And it wasn't until my 30s that I decided to give this college thing a try. And when I got to college, I discovered what science actually was, as opposed to what I thought it was, and fell in love with it, and ended up becoming a physicist. And during that journey, I was shocked to discover that I was autistic. I got a diagnosis for Asperger's syndrome back when you could still get that diagnosis. Today it would be called ASD level 1. And it was such a shock to me to learn that my weirdness had a name and that there were other people out there who had the same sorts of struggles I had. That's not anything I ever would have guessed at. And as I started to learn more about autism, I came to a deeper understanding about myself and why I am the way I am. And it also helped me better connect with other people and figure out, oh, this is an autistic trait that for me is just common in an everyday fact of life, but it's an autistic trait, which means most people don't go through this. And now other people have better context for me. I can better understand them. And there are a lot of misconceptions about autism. I myself was like deeply offended when I first found out that I might be autistic, but that's because I had a lot of misconceptions about what autism actually is. And from that day to this, I've been a passionate self-advocate, in part for my own survival, to help people better to understand me and to open up a conversation in a manner that we could kind of bypass some of my social disabilities and stuff and have an honest, frank discussion so we can come to understand each other a little bit better. Because like all human beings, I want to be understood. I want to understand you. And I want us to have a means of communication where we both get what the other one is saying and kind of understand each other. That's a very important thing for all human beings. And I am absolutely... it's absolutely essential for me. But I also have three kids that are also on the spectrum, not necessarily the same part of the spectrum as me. And in 2017, when I got my PhD in solid state physics, for my study was on gamma spectrometers for astrophysics applications, That's when my boss came to me and said, I'm opening up a center to help autistic adults find meaningful employment, and I want you to be the director. And I couldn't say no. It's just such a wonderful opportunity. You know, when I first found out that there were other people out there like me, my first immediate thought was, I was heartbroken. The idea that anybody would have to go through what I went through to try and make the weirdness of this world work for me, like nobody should have to go through that. That just broke my heart. And so the opportunity to try and help other people maybe find that path a little bit easier than I did, yeah, that seems like a life well worth spent. That's a life well worth living. And I'm happy and delighted to do it. And that's what I've been doing for the last 5 years. And I've never been happier. This is I like to joke that I'm basically being paid to be me. I could be me for free. It's no effort to be me. You know, I get to do what I want to do, and I get paid really well to do it. And that is the dream job, I think, that we're all chasing and stuff. So I'm living the American dream, and over 80% of people on the autism spectrum are unemployed or underemployed. And that includes people with bachelor's degrees, graduate degrees. So clearly, there's a lot that science still doesn't understand about autism. But what we do know is that with the right accommodations and the right supports, these people have very specialized minds. Even folks in the level 3 version of the autism spectrum, people with moderate to severe intellectual disabilities, nonverbal, because of their autism, there are some things they can do just as well, if not better, than most people. We want them in the right sort of job that really harnesses those strengths to where they could be really effective at what they're doing. The right mind and the right sort of job. This is something we all want as society. Our society works better when you've got the right minds with the right tools and the right job and stuff. We all just work better as a society. And so that's the main focus of our research and our efforts and stuff, is what sort of technologies, innovations, ways of doing things are needed for these people to find and thrive in meaningful employment.
So I'm going to take one step back, because I feel like there's a lot of information about autism out there, and it feels like the science and definitions are always shifting. You mentioned Asperger's and, you know, ASD. Can you tell us how the Frist Center defines autism and just what that diagnosis means?
So, yeah, maybe if I can take a step back a little bit from that and kind of describe how autism comes about. That might actually help, because the spectrum is confusing for a lot of people. It was confusing for me for a long time. I remember researching it and looking at it, and at one point in time, I thought I wouldn't be surprised if what we call autism today, maybe 10 or 15 years from now, might actually be 5 different conditions that just look similar, because it's so varied. It's a multivariable spectrum and stuff. The old adage, if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism. That's because you could really get to know somebody with autism and then meet somebody else with autism and see it expressed differently. And then that can get confusing, because as human beings, we like to put things in a box. We like nice, clear labels and stuff. But at its core, all human beings, when we're infants, our brain just grows wild like brush. And it has we end up with too many connections, like wild brush of all these neural pathways and stuff. And then in the first few months of our life, there's this pruning process that whittles that down to highways and connections and stuff that form the brain that most of us have, the neuromajority sort of brain. Those of us on the autism spectrum, there's something wrong with that pruning process, and we end up with too many connections. And when you think about autism from that perspective, suddenly the spectrum makes a lot of sense. Like the only real difference between me, you know, someone who's able to hold a full-time job, get a PhD in physics and do work, and someone else on the spectrum who is entirely nonverbal, severe intellectual disabilities, never be able to independently live on their own. They'll always need somebody to take care of them. The only real difference between us is I got lucky. My too many pathways is not too crippling. It does create challenges, which the more common symptoms of autism are we have a bit of a social disability. It's difficult for us to relate to other people. It's difficult for us to read nonverbal cues and stuff. We're very blunt and literal speakers. The words for us have a very specific definition, and your tone of voice or your body language or the context doesn't change that definition. So if you say one thing, but you mean something slightly different, or you mean the opposite of what you're saying, I'm more likely to interpret the literal interpretation of your words rather than what you actually meant. And a lot of people are just so used to people being able to get what they mean that they play fast and loose with the language. But that's something we have difficulty doing. Our too many connections we have to like sort of settle on the literal side. And there are other things like sensory issues and stuff like that. Like I said, it's a multivariable spectrum. But the way the Frist Center sort of defines autism, other than just like relying on the actual clinical definition of autism itself, is I like to use the compare and contrast of neurodivergent versus the neuromajority. Neurodiversity itself is a term that calls attention to the fact there's no such thing as a normal brain. There are variations in the normal brain, variations in skills and capabilities and ways of thinking. That's just normal. That's a normal part of the human process. But for the neuromajority, about two-thirds of the population, their basic brain wiring is similar enough to one another that they can come to an understanding with each other, they can relate to each other, they can talk to each other and kind of connect fairly well. And that's important for us as a species because our species is all about coming together as a group and working collaboratively. For about the other third of us, our wiring is differently enough that we end up being neurodivergent. And this is not necessarily a good or bad thing. You know, like I like to just explain people like with my own autism, I like to say, look, more ways than not, I'm a human being with all the complexities and nuances that comes with that, just like every other human being, more often than not, in more ways than not. But in some very important fundamental ways, I'm wired differently than most people. And what that means is sometimes I think about a problem differently than most people. I have a perspective differently than most people. I even use language differently than most people. And if you're different enough, if you're outside the box in your thinking and your thought patterns and how you interact with the world, that can make relating to other people and connecting to other people difficult.
Okay, so we talked about some of the challenges. You know, we've heard about the struggles, you know, from you and then, you know, in the media and all that stuff that neurodiverse individuals face. So what are the strengths and kind of the super abilities that are the other side of that coin?
Yeah. And one of the really fascinating things about neurodivergence is that this is not just related to autism, dyslexia, dyspraxia, Tourette's syndrome. Like if you look at all these and you take a more holistic approach in looking at the strengths and challenges, you find there are commonalities. It's almost like as an autistic individual, I'm a particular flavor of human being. And this particular flavor of human being, there is a collection of challenges and struggles, but there's also a collection of strengths. We're very detail-oriented. Paying attention to the details and stuff is something that's like really, because we're naturally wired for that. Now, sometimes it's important, some jobs, some task, like nitpicking and paying very close attention to all the details is like really good in some arenas. And in other arenas, it's much better if you're more of a broad strokes, big picture sort of person. Sometimes we can struggle with some of the big picture stuff, but we're really great at some of the detail-oriented things as a group in general. It is a spectrum. You'll find individuals who are maybe like just average from everybody else, and then you'll find other individuals that almost have like, you know, really phenomenal abilities to focus on the details. We have, I myself in particular, have a very strong hyper-focus, which means when I'm working on something, that becomes my entire universe. I'm not like working on this task and also thinking about something else and worrying about something else and listening to music and stuff. Like I am laser focused. All of my cognitive processes are focused on the task at hand. There are some jobs where that's really useful to have. You know, I can work on a complex multivariable problem for days, weeks, months without getting frustrated, without getting bored. Like that, you want someone like me as a scientist because you need that sort of thing to be a good scientist, right? But I've been in other jobs where that like hyper-focus and stuff has gotten me into trouble, where they really want me to just let this thing go and move on to the next thing or try to juggle multiple things at once. Myself personally, I'm not so good at that. And I don't want to generalize. I've met some people on the spectrum that are. But another thing is like pattern recognition, you know, and this is probably one of the ones that people might be more familiar with. This idea that Hollywood sometimes plays this off to be like some sort of magical ability or something. Underneath all that nonsense, there is a bit of truth to it that I've seen like really complex patterns where most people, it could take them like several minutes to try to dig through it and find some subtle variation to the pattern where some autistic people could glance at it and that pattern just leaps right out at them and they almost instantly spot it. There are some particular jobs where autistic people like get paid really, really well where that company is like taking advantage of the fact that this person can pour through reams of data and pick up subtle variations in pattern and flag it for another team to look at. Those are just some of the advantages we have. And I'll finally say, I don't know if this is necessarily an advantage, but just a product of the system. We work closely with some companies that have a proven track record of hiring and successfully employing and accommodating neurodivergent talent in their workforce. And one of the most common things I hear from the supervisors that work from those folks is that it took a little getting used to. We can be very blunt and direct in our language. But when they recognize we're not trying to be rude and we're not trying to hurt someone's feelings, this is just how we communicate. And those supervisors put some thought and efforts to speaking to us and saying exactly what they mean so we can understand them. And a dialogue forms, they're always astounded at how hardworking and honest and loyal we are. We're honest because that's the only way one can effectively communicate. And we're hardworking and loyal because for us, that might be the first time we're in a work environment where instead of everybody yelling at us and expecting us to be something we're not, people take the time to understand us and they treat us with dignity and respect, and they create a workplace where we feel valued. This is the part that surprises me. Anyone would be hardworking and loyal in an environment like that. Like, that's not an autistic trait. That's just a human trait that I'm finally in a place where I feel like I'm understood and I belong and I'm treated with respect and dignity and I'm valued for my strengths and accomplishments. Of course, one would be hardworking and loyal in that environment.
Of course. Can you talk a bit more about the business case for bringing neurodiverse individuals into an organization?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And I'm trying to think of the best place to start. Let's peel back a little bit and let's just talk about the value of diversity itself. So why is diversity important in the workplace? Why is diversity important in the office? There are some people who make the argument that there's a moral issue there about trying to like treat everybody with dignity and respect and make a space at the table for everyone and stuff. That I agree with that 100%, but let's set that aside and I'm going to talk purely selfish business interest for a moment here. If you have, let's say you have two hypothetical teams and one team, everyone there is from the same background, the same culture, the same upbringing, the same school. They all think alike. Now, in some ways, that's a really desirable thing because everybody's sort of in sync. Everybody gets each other. They feel like a family. You know, they're all like marching to the beat of the same drum. There are some advantages to that. But if you hit that group with a novel problem where they have to come up with a solution, you might get several copies of the same identical solution because they all have the same perspective. They're all thinking about it the same way. So they might arrange the problem in the same way and come up with the same sort of conclusion. In some instances, that might be a good thing, but imagine another team that has more diversity of thought. Some of those people are from different backgrounds, different cultures, different perspectives. So instead of getting copies of the same solution over and over again, now you're getting a variety of suggestions of potential solutions. And some of those might be unfeasible. Some of them might be impracticable, but some of them can also be really brilliant. I would say any company who is thinking to themselves, we need some outside the box thinkers. We need a fresh set of eyes. We need somebody come at this from another angle, or we want more angles so we could potentially identify some issues that we might have missed otherwise. If you see the value in that, then how can you not be for diversity in the workplace? And neurodiversity is effectively the same sort of thing. Look, there are people will see me do one thing and they'll get a glimmer of my intelligence and capabilities and they'll put me at a certain level. And then they'll see me struggle with some things that most people, it's so easy for them to do that they have a hard time imagining how could one struggle with this. It's so obvious to me. It's so easy for me. Therefore, it should be easy for you. But in my case, it's not. It's actually really hard and complex for me to poorly imitate what other people can do so natural as breathing. But on the flip side, there is absolutely a flip side. There are things that I can do that are so easy and trivial for me that to other people sometimes look like magic or something. That doesn't mean I'm better than them. It doesn't mean I'm worse than them. I have a specialized brain. I have a brain that in certain contexts with certain accommodations and stuff could be extremely valuable and useful. And what I particularly enjoy out of being able to work effectively as a team is I get to be a specialist and be good at what I'm at. And then I have all these other people who are good at a whole bunch of things I'm not good at that I can rely upon and lean on to sort of like borrow their strengths and capabilities to help me through the parts that I struggle with. And then I'm more than delighted to help them with the parts that are easy for me that they struggle with. And working together as a group as a whole, we accomplish great things. I feel like at its core, that's what every company wants, right? They want their team being able to work effectively together. They want them to be versatile. They want them to be able to handle a variety of issues. They want them to be coming up with new ideas and better ways of doing things. If you really want that for your company, then you want neurodivergent talent in there. And I should clarify to the point, you probably have some neurodivergent talent in there already, but you're probably not doing a good job of accommodating them. Probably have some elements of your work environment that's holding them back. So it really behooves us to take a second look at how we run businesses, how we run, foster the workplace environment and stuff. How are we treating each other? How are we talking to each other? And try to be a little bit more flexible to not everybody thinks the same way. Not everybody uses language in the same way. If we can be a little patient and understanding and try to get to know each other a little bit better and kind of learn one another's strengths and ways of approaching a problem, then we can work more effectively as a team.
So you mentioned, you know, bringing neurodiverse individuals in. You know, what are the accommodations that typically need to be made in the workplace specifically?
Yeah, and accommodations is one of those funny words that I think a lot of companies or businesses, they hear accommodations and they immediately imagine like installing ramps and widening chairs, like these really big, expensive sort of things. So I sometimes see there's a sort of a knee-jerk sort of reticence to consider accommodations. But most accommodations for neurodivergent people are little to no cost. It's really just about changing how you talk to people. And being mindful of the fact that, you know, the way you normally communicate with people that you really get along with and stuff works really well for those kinds of people, but that's not always going to translate well in the office. And some of these people, well, if you take myself, for example, one of the things about my autism is I have extreme sensory meltdowns. One or more of my senses can be overwhelmed, and that decays my cognitive processes. And is plus it's not a lot of fun to go through. It's like can be very painful and disorienting and stuff. And so one of the accommodations I might seek out in a workplace is, hey, I might need to put on noise canceling headsets because sometimes my hyperfocus works against me and there's a distraction going on in the background and my brain's just latched onto it and I cannot focus on the task and I can't do the work. I've got to be able to block that out. Or it might actually be physically painful for me, or it might actually be degrading my ability to think. You know, maybe I need to wear shades or maybe I need to move to another office. One accommodation I saw, one of the many autistic adults that we've worked with, she was trying to seek out an accommodation through a workplace. They had her desk right next to the water cooler. And about the same time every day, her coworkers would gather together and talk about whatever TV show they watched or something, which is fine. This is a bit of social bonding and stuff. You know, it helps kind of people kind of connect, but she could not get her work done with that. And she ended up like an hour and a half was just like waste of time of being very frustrated. And because she, this is not unusual for autistic people. When I show up to work, I'm there to work. That's my role there. So when I go to work, I want to work. And that's all I want to do. I just want to focus on my work and work and work and work and work and work until it's time to go home. And then I'm ready to do something else. And so she was trying to ask them to move and they weren't being very receptive to it. And I kind of helped her work on the language of saying, you know, hey, this is very distracting for me and it makes it difficult for me to do my job. If you could please move me to the other end of the office where that's not so close to me, I can focus on doing my job. And I told her, I said, be confident when you ask for this accommodation, because effectively you're just asking your boss, you know, I want to be more effective at my job and this is what I need to be able to do that. Your boss wants that too, whether they realize it or not. They'd probably be delighted that they have someone who's just like so dedicated and driven to like trying to do their best work and stuff. And she asked for the accommodation and she got it. Sometimes accommodations are just as simple as that. But if you have autistic employees in your office today, and there's a really good chance you do, some of us are pretty good at masking, social camouflaging, walking and talking and acting as if we're a normal person. So people will hire us and keep us in the job and stuff, and then we just it becomes an invisible disability where we're just kind of struggling. They're going to be hesitant to ask for an accommodation if they have the slightest suspicion or sense that you're probably going to judge them as lesser, or you're going to make a lot of assumptions based on your own misunderstanding of autism. So if you even want an opportunity for those employees to come forward, you have to kind of make it clear in your workplace culture. Look, we recognize here that not everybody's brain works the same way. Some people have unique challenges. Some people have different perspectives. We see the value in that, and we appreciate those folks. So we want people to be a little patient with one another. We want them to kind of be understanding with one another. If you foster that sort of environment, those autistic and neurodivergent employees are going to be emboldened that maybe I could talk to you about something that's holding me back. Maybe we could have that sort of conversation and just try to have an open, constructive, conversation. And most of the accommodations that we need are not that big a ask. But the biggest problem comes in is that most, let me say this a different way. All human beings need accommodations. Like the temperature in the workplace, the noise level, the language that we use to talk to each other in a professional manner. All of these things have been crafted to accommodate human beings. If it's too loud, if it's too bright, if it's too dark, if there's sort of a toxic vibe where people are just sniping at each other all the time. Like these are all things that are not good for humans to thrive in that environment while they're there to get their job done and stuff. So there's a whole mess of accommodations set into place that we don't think of as accommodation because this is just good business. This is just how it should be done. If you recognize that someone who's wired differently, their ideal environment might look a little differently from that. Not radically different, but you know, they might need some, you know, some people think of it as special accommodations, but it's really just an accommodation that works best for them. And maybe it doesn't work best for everybody else because everybody else doesn't need that accommodation. We should be a little bit more flexible as much as humanly possible. I mean, obviously, if someone has some crazy off the wall, like, you know, we need to keep all the lights off or we need to keep the temperature at 50 degrees, that's obviously not going to work for everybody else. There obviously has to be a compromise there. But I think far too often people just assume, well, this works well for me and this works well for most of my employees. Therefore, it must work well for you. Suck it up, buttercup. That's not always going to get you the best out of that employee.
Oh, that makes sense. Definitely. I love that you brought up the fact that, you know, every office environment is built for accommodations. We are making accommodations to a certain group of individuals in that office. And yeah, we just need to kind of turn that on its head and make it apply to everybody. So you touched on this a little bit, but can you talk more about the kind of training that managers of neurodiverse individuals can have, or, you know, or just what they should expect? How can they be a better manager?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a question we've been thinking about pretty seriously about for the last 5 years. And when we first got started, there were some companies out there like Specialist Sterna. Over 75% of their employees are on the spectrum. The overwhelming majority of those employees had never had a full-time job. Some of them had graduate degrees and had never been and been like unemployed or underemployed for like 5-10 years. And now they're working 10-15 years in a career full-time, like just crushing it. And Specialist Sterna is a for-profit company. You know, they're not doing they recognize that the value in there. But what was as a scientist, what's keenly interested to me is that you have supervisors that have entire teams of autistic employees that they're managing. And I would frequently talk to them and interview them and try to figure out, you know, what was your process? How did this kind of work out for you? And the overwhelming thing I heard from all of them is that when they first got that job, they were absolutely terrified. They knew that they were going to be working with autistic people. They didn't really know what that meant. Mm. You know, could they do something wrong? Do they even know what would be wrong? You know, just the fear of the unknown and stuff was like very, very terrifying for them. But they were brave individuals. They still stepped into it and tried to learn from it. And after working a week or two with these autistic employees, the first thing they were bowled over with was how easy it actually is. It's not hard to work with an autistic person. If you have a basic understanding of how our brains function and how we use language, like I said, we're very literal speakers. Sometimes we say things that if a normal person said it, it was because they're attacking you or they're trying to cut you down, or they're trying to hurt your feelings. You know, they're just uttering facts about you that might not be flattering or might not be something you want to think about. But for us, there's no malice behind that. And when you recognize that and don't immediately go with a knee-jerk emotional reaction, you can take a step back and realize, oh, this is just how we're kind of communicating. And when you put some thought and effort in how to talk to us, a good rule of thumb I like to say is that when you're talking to someone that you suspect may be neurodivergent and it seems like there might be some miscommunication, treat your language as if you were sending them a text and you have no emoticons. You have no emojis. You can't use emojis, right? You type something that could be taken the wrong way, and then you put like the little tongue-in-cheek emoji or something like that to let show people that you're not being serious or something. If you take that away, you have to be a little bit more careful about how you phrase things. You want to make sure that the sentence read on its own by itself accurately conveys the message that you're trying to give. And it takes, for some people who are not used to that, maybe it takes a little effort. It's a bit of a learning process, but it's not really all that difficult. And once they do that, and now they and their employees are on the same page, and there's effective two-way communication where I understand you and you understand me, everything else just becomes easy. So it's actually not that hard. And to a lesser extent, I think that same strategy is effective with any sort of neurodivergence, not just autism. It's just basically trying to take the time to understand what is this person's communication style. And the final point I'll say on that is that there are a lot of soft skills of human interaction that most people just sort of like, from my perspective, have this magical ability to just sort of like pick up without any formal training or anything like that. Like, to me, it looks like magic. It's amazing to me how deeply and on how many levels people can be communicating with one another. Sometimes it seems like the words are just noises they're making, and that all of the real communication is like something that I'm missing out on because I don't have that. And as a consequence to that, there are some things that most people feel is just obvious about how you talk to each other, what you say, what you don't say, that sometimes we are going to say something that a regular person would be like, oh my God, what earth would anyone ever think that that was acceptable in this context? That is so clearly beyond the bounds, unacceptable. And this is where the mistake that people make. They think like, what mindset would I be in to say that? Oh, I would be a monster, or I would just be a very cruel human being or something. Therefore, this person must be a cruel human being, and they attack this person. If this person's autistic, it might have been said in a completely innocent way. You know, I warn people when I interact with people, and I'm going to see them more on a short version like this, but we're going to be like hanging out and talking at some point, I might drop my guard. You know, masking and walking and talking and acting like a normal person is very taxing and tiring for me. At some point, I might just relax and just be more honest with them. And I tell them, like, I might say something that might come across as cruel or offensive. Please understand, there's a very high degree of probability I did not mean it that way. And I'm only as good at talking to people as I am because I've had kind-hearted souls pull me aside and say, hey, the way you said that, you can't do that. Like, this is how it makes people feel. This is how they're going to respond to it. Now, I would be like, that doesn't make sense to me. Of course it doesn't make sense to me, because if I had any idea how damaging it could be, I never would have said it. You know, that's one of the great tragedies of us autistic people, is that we can really tromp on feelings and really upset and offend people and just have no clue. Because if you talk to us the same way, you would see, you wouldn't even get a rise out of us. It's so much easier to hurt other people's feelings if you don't get hurt the same way in return. And it's much more difficult to figure out where those boundaries lie. So we have to rely on other people to take a breath and just have an honest conversation with us. So those supervisors also have that role, is that if they see someone who's just acting in a clearly unprofessional way, they got to sit them down and have a conversation with them. And what makes that conversation go best is if you try to explain the logic and the reasoning behind it. Mm-hmm. Don't just say, you can't do this. That's not really helpful for us because we don't understand the context of why it's not acceptable. Maybe it was our tone of voice. Maybe it was because, you know, we were shouting, or maybe it was because the topic is just one that one should never have in polite conversation. Maybe we had a conversation like that with some buddies that we were playing a game with, and you say, yeah, that's a different context. That's not a professional context. you know, in a professional environment, you should just never bring that up, or you should only talk about it in this context. Like those of us who are good at social interaction with most people have had a lot of kind-hearted people who've pulled us aside. So sometimes supervisors have got to do that. But we are trainable. We do want to get along with people, and we do want to understand people. And if someone can use clear, blunt, direct language to explain things to us, those people become beacons for us. You know, I would not be where I'm at today if I didn't have kind-hearted folks. And when I think back into the past of my early days when I didn't understand anything and this whole world was complex, the idea of removing one of those few people from my life terrifies me, because I would not be successful today. I wouldn't have a full-time job. I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in if it wasn't for these kind-hearted souls guiding me and helping me figure out all the things that are incomprehensible to me and perhaps obvious and trivial for you to understand.
That's amazing. So I'm hoping the Frist Center is one of those kind-hearted souls that can do the same thing for companies to bring in organizations. So go ahead, give us a plug for what you guys do and let us know how you guys can help.
And thank you so much, because in your original question that was couched in there and I got lost in the weeds of my explanation, but you're absolutely right. So we are primarily a research institution, but one of the ways that you're able to research this problem is by working with companies, nonprofits, academia, researchers, governments, like anyone who's a stakeholder in our mission, we are interested in engaging with, we're interested in talking to, and we work with companies and corporations all the time. Initially, it was the ones who were ahead of the curve, and it was more like, can we learn some of your secret sauce? Can we try to figure out what works and why does it work? And then what can we learn from that to help other companies? Now, today, 5 years on, more and more, a lot of the new companies we're talking to are people who are wanting to start. And it's been everything from mom and pop shops to multinational corporations and stuff and everything in between. I've talked to individual supervisors who had an employee that they suspected was autistic, and there was some great work that they were doing, but there were some challenges and they were just looking for some help or guidance on effective communication strategies and stuff. We've talked to people who want to hire 3,000 autistic people to like put in 6 centers across you know, North America, and they're wanting to know some of the best ways to do that and everything in between. I like to think of the Frist Center as sort of a nexus point for resources. So anybody who has any question related to neurodivergence and the workplace, they're free to reach out to us. We do what we can to help folks. We're delighted to point people towards resources and stuff. And what we're actually getting out of it, if you want to talk from a purely selfish perspective, is that in working with these people, we better refine how to build our training materials, what works and what doesn't, and in what ways it works. So it's actually furthering our own research mission and stuff. So virtually all of my interactions are win-win scenarios where you're getting something of value out of it. I'm getting something of value out of it. We're both delighted to connect and be able to help each other. That's my job all day, every day. And what an amazing job that is.
That's awesome. So we're going to go ahead and open up the floor to questions. I know people are really passionate about this. And, you know, I know that particularly with innovation and R&D, we want as much neurodiversity as possible. So this is a huge issue for our members in particular. So, you know, please, if you want to type your questions into the chat, if you feel more comfortable that way, or you can go ahead and ask Dave here. We've already got Nancy ready to go. So what question do you have for Dave, Nancy?
Dave, what do you think would happen if a person were to go to a job interview and reveal that they were neurodivergent?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And by the way, that is a question that neurodivergent people struggle with daily. I try to caution people that I'm very unusual in one respect. As an autistic adult, I do not represent the vast majority in that I'm comfortable and willing to talk to people about my struggles and talk to people about my differences. That's not the norm amongst autistic people. Most autistic people are terrified of people finding out that they might be autistic or they might struggle in some way, because they have a very real fear. I think it's not entirely an I think it's a legitimate fear that people are going to hear the autism word. They have a lot of misconceptions of what that means, and they end up dehumanizing this person and thinking of them as lesser or inferior. and treating them based on their own preconceived notions and stuff. And so I have neurodivergent people come to me all the time talking about, you know, should I advocate for myself? Should I come out and admit in an interview or admit to my boss that I'm autistic? A lot of people feel like the strategy is just mask, walk and talk and try to pretend like you're normal. There's a downside to that, because that means that we have unmet needs, or we might have some challenges and stuff that we're just trying to hide behind and stuff. And so we can end up struggling. And I think it's one of the big reasons why we have such a high unemployment, underemployment rate. But the answer to that I try to give autistic folks and neurodivergent folks is that, yeah, if you come to someone and you say, I'm autistic or I'm dyslexic or whatever, that label might have a lot of negative connotations. There might be a lot of misunderstanding. So I recommend you avoid labels, especially if you're one of those people who are terrified of people hearing the A word, the autism word, and don't want that to be associated with them. I say give up labels in favor of descriptors. And one of the most common examples I use is that, like, if I was not comfortable admitting to people that I was autistic and I had a sensory problem within the workplace where I needed noise canceling headsets and I was going to ask for that accommodation. Let's say I work in an office where they're like, nobody can have earbuds in, nobody could add headphones in, you know, that's just a rule. So I'm asking for a special exception. One of the ways I could use a descriptor instead of a label, I could go in with a label and say, I'm autistic and I need headsets. And there's a really good chance that's not gonna end well, or that's not gonna do me any favors or something. But if instead I go to them and I say, look, I have a neurological difference. I have a sensory processing disorder. And sometimes I get overwhelmed by noises. And noise canceling headsets helps stave that off. And I'm able to more effectively focus on the task at hand. And so please, so I could be more effective at my job, I'm please asking to let me wear some noise canceling headsets when I'm doing this work. I've still advocated for myself, but I've done it in a descriptive language in a way that my supervisor could understand. And now it seems like a reasonable request. I've not just asked for something, but I've explained a little bit about, and notice I never use the A word. You know, I share that to some autistic people and they look at me like it was just a beam from the mountain, you know, because it never stopped. It never occurred to them. Like, we use very blunt and direct language and stuff. We use very precise language. Yeah, that's not always the best way to talk to other people. Sometimes a descriptor I think is much more effective than an assumption that they understand what the labels mean. But to properly answer your question, I think for most neurodivergent people, if they recognize there's a non-zero probability that their neurodivergence is going to cause issues in the workplace, And sometimes when those issues start to arise and then you disclose, it's a little bit harder after the fact, because a lot of humans tend to look at that as making up excuses. There's a very negative connotation about disclosing after the fact. There is some wisdom in trying to get ahead of that and laying the groundwork. So if that happens, you can do a callback and maybe garner a little bit more understanding. So myself personally, I'm a big believer in trying to find a means of being able to advocate for yourself. Now, the reality is that depends on the workplace culture. If you're in one of those workplace cultures that are toxic and they expect everybody to think the same way and everybody to act the same way, and they come down on harshly on anything that diverges in any way, shape, or form from what they think is normal or acceptable, you're probably going to have a lot of problems advocating for yourself in that. But I also encourage people who are neurodivergent that if you do find yourself in that environment, you need to look for another job. That's not a good company for you.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you. Nancy, any other questions for Dave, or does anyone else want to jump in too?
Well, I can bring up another one, but I don't want to hog the floor. Does anyone else have something?
I say go for it.
Okay. One time I had a, you know, definitely neurodivergent person that, you know, I came in, I was hired in after him, and I found that he had forged a relationship with a coworker who almost, they were compatible. She had figured out, she had gotten past the storming and norming and all of that. She was a neurotypical person. And so I kept them together and treated them like as two in a box. And there was things that you couldn't ask one person to do, but the other one was good at, and vice versa. And I was just wondering, you know, he didn't identify himself as neurodivergent, and I never said he was. This is just based on behavior. It would have been helpful to me, though, to advocate for him more in the company if I could explain his differences. The one who was typical was maybe not more valuable than him, but her behavior was much more understandable in the corporate context. So I was just wondering if you think, you know, was my strategy a good one, or should I have made sure that he separated from this other employee and could stand on his own feet, or?
Oh, well, in terms of like letting them lean on and support each other, and letting their relevant strengths cover for each other's challenges and struggles or something, like, that's what I think we should all be doing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think this idea that somebody within an organization should be able to stand alone and do everything by themselves with perfect confidence, or they don't belong in that organization. I have a lot of problems with that hypothetical organization. I don't think that's a very good organization. I'm thinking, what's the point of you guys even getting together if you're just going to throw everybody out to the wolves? I really feel like, look, it's the most human thing in the world. About 2-3% of the population is autistic. And we've only recently started to be able to understand autism and diagnose autism, but there's a lot of evidence that this is not a new phenomenon. That our species, probably for almost as long as there's been human, is there's a small subset of us who are autistic. And from an evolutionary perspective, it's pretty easy to see. Temple Grandin, I think, said it best when she was like, who do you think it was who invented the flint spear? Was it the cave people like hanging out around the fire, chatting and hanging out, or that weird one in the back of the cave banging rocks together? Like, if you have a tribe, a group of people committed to one another's survival and supporting each other, and there are specialists within that group who are able to do certain things much better than everybody else, and the rest of the group takes care of them because they might be bad at everything else, but they're good at this one thing, like, you are much more effective. Like, there's an evolutionary, if you have two tribes living in a valley that can only support one, and one of them has more diversity of tools and stuff and are banded together and working out, we're helping each other and supporting each other, and the other ones is that every person for themselves or like very monotonous. It's not hard to see which one is more likely to survive. By our very nature, being able to help each other and lift each other up and support each other when we need it, for me, that's the sign of a good company. And I would say that's the sign of a good manager. Absolutely. Whether the company would agree with me or not, I can't even posit a guess, but I can definitely say, if I was your boss, I would be like, you're doing a fabulous job. I need you to train some of my other managers.
Thank you.
Nice bit of validation there, Nancy. That's good. Right. Do we have any other questions for Dave? All right.
I don't know why. Okay. It's not so much a question, but just an observation. So I have two people in my family that I know of, because of course it's not something everybody broadcasts and there's a sign above their head. But my niece and my nephew, from two different brothers, they're both on different ends of the spectrum for neurodiversity. And it is because of them that I have become an advocate for having people who do have this ability. And I say of an ability because there you can bring to the table a lot more than people think, and sometimes better than me. And sometimes their brain processes and comes up with ideas and concepts I would never have thought of. And so it is important that we have these conversations, and maybe also put in our hiring that we do, you know, advocate and champion and want people of different abilities, whether it is a neural ability, whether it is a physical ability, because that's what makes organizations creative and innovative and move forward.
Yeah, I mean, those are some excellent points, and it reminds me of one of the things that most people on the spectrum struggle with, which is the job interview. Because we use language differently, because we're honest to a fault, that's one of the stumbling blocks. And so if you're a company that wants to hire neurodivergent talent, one of the first places you want to look is like your HR department. How are you conducting interviews? Like something as innocuous as how you're phrasing the question. Like if you ask me, you know, where will you be in 5 years? If we hire you, where will you be in 5 years? That's an impossible question for me to answer. And I will get stressed out and anxious about it because I'll want to answer your question honestly, but I don't know if I'm going to like the company. I don't know if I'm going to like the boss. I don't know if it's going to be a convenient place. Like, how can I imagine myself like where I would be if I don't have all of that information? So for me, it's an impossible question. And most autistic people are going to get very anxious. Then we're going to be awkward. And that's probably going to set you off as well. This person's acting weird. And you're probably going to pass this over in favor of someone else who's like a really smooth talker. That same question, if you ask, you know, if things work out for you in the company, where would you like to be in 5 years? Now, you might think, wait, Dave, those are the same two questions. No, they're not. Not for an autistic person. That other question is a very different question than the first one, because now it's couched in the maybes of maybe I work here, maybe I don't. But if I'm assuming that I like it and everything goes where would I like to be? That's a question I could answer. And I'd be a lot more calm and confident about it. But even then, you know, I try to stress to people, there was a 60 Minutes piece done about our works at the Frist Center last year. And there was this one girl that she was one of my favorite quotes out of all of them. They asked her, if there's any one thing you want people to understand about autism, what would it be? And she thought about it for a moment and she said, you shouldn't judge my intelligence based on my ability to talk. One of the things I try to, and I'm embarrassed that I forgot this, but it's absolutely something that I should mention. I am on the hyperverbal end of the spectrum. If you can't tell, I have a pretty expansive vocabulary. I'm able to speak and sound intelligent while I do so. People have a tendency to judge your intelligence based on how well you can talk. But I know some people on the spectrum who are arguably smarter than me and more capable than I am. I can think of one guy in particular, like his ability to manage a dozen projects and some of the innovations that he's created, his brain is just a problem-solving machine and he's just a workhorse. And the work that he does is amazing. But if you try to have a conversation with him, it might take him 30 seconds to string together a simple sentence. And you know when people hear him talk, he sounds slow. And they assume so much less than what he's actually capable of and stuff. So let's think back to the job interview. I mean, I think we can, if we're honest with ourselves, we can all look and see that the job interview doesn't really do a good job of figuring out how good you would be at the job. Mm-hmm. What it really does is figure out how good of a talker you are. And you could have an autistic employee who's not very good at selling themselves, not very good at talking themselves up. Might seem awkward and have difficulty making eye contact and all these things that make normal, regular people like uncomfortable, but might be a brilliant coder, might be a brilliant programmer, and you'll pass them over for this other person who's like laughing at your jokes or making you laugh and carrying on a good two-way conversation and stuff. And that person might be a good talker, but a terrible coder. So our job interviews aren't really set up in most places to find how good you are at the actual work itself. It's more just sort of like a sounding out of a personality and how well a communicator this person is. I would say, like, look, if you're hiring somebody to sit at the front desk and greet strangers all day, then obviously communication is like super, super important. But if it's somebody writing code all day or working in another job where that may not be the most important thing, if you only restrict yourself to the people who are good talkers, you're leaving a lot of talent and a lot of capability off the table. And you might be passing over the very best candidates simply because you have that preconceived notion that they have to also be good talkers.
So what are some other ways then? You know, would it be, you know, like a piece of code they need, a piece of work you needed them to do? Would it be written communication?
Yeah, well, I mean, first and foremost, this, you know, for most people, they form a pretty solid opinion about somebody within the first 30 seconds that they're talking to them. You have to recognize that if an autistic person is going to warm up, it's not going to be in the first 30 seconds or the first minute. like there has to be a bit of trust and dialogue kind of built to get them a little bit to relax and kind of talk. So if you're one of those people who have make those snap judgment decisions in the first 30 seconds or minute of an interview, you're doing yourself no favors. You're trying to judge an autistic or a neurodivergent people based off of norms that don't really apply to them. And that's not going to get you an accurate sounding of how affected this person is. But that being said, the companies who hire large numbers of neurodivergent talent and do so successfully have almost entirely gotten rid of the interview process. Instead, what they do is they give them tasks. And they watch how they manage the task. How do you actually, like if you're a coder, let me give you a block of data and ask you, you know, I want you to find a particular parameter and then just watch and see how that person does that, how long that takes them and stuff. One of the most effective companies I know, the one that has over 75% success rate, they have like a 2 or 3 week sort of like onboarding program where they're actually teaching them soft skills and professional skills while they're measuring their aptitude and capabilities in a variety of jobs. And by the end of that 3 weeks, not only have they trained this person up to be able to function properly in a professional setting, but they also have a really good idea of where their strengths are and what their capabilities are. And then that informs them on the hiring process of where that person ends up in that organization. That's been really successful for them. If you're a company that's looking for help with that, you don't have to figure all that out yourself. That is one of the most common things that we help companies with. So it's as simple as if you want to explore that rabbit hole and see what it entails, you know, just reach out to me at the Frist Center. We have lots of resources available for you. I'm happy to sit down and have a conversation and kind of go over the minutiae of how to make that functional.
And that is a perfect way to end. You get the little tag for the Frist Center at the end. So perfect. So Dave, I really appreciate your openness and, you know, your willingness to answer all of our questions. This has been awesome. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for everyone who joined us today and for everyone who's listening later on. Join me next month. I'll be interviewing Brennan Marcano from the GEM Fellows Program, and that'll be on October 20th at noon. And I look forward to seeing everyone there. And again, Dave, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Fantastic. You guys have a wonderful day.
Thanks. Bye-bye.